Hello, everybody. Good morning, DEF CON. We're going to go ahead and get started, so hold on to your seats, all right?
Thank you so much for joining us at such an ungodly hour. Do we have any headaches in the room? Show of hands, because we can write you something for this after the talk. Come see us.
It's awesome to see you all here. One of the problems with the con, if you can call it a problem, is that it's hard to choose between all the awesome tracks and all the awesome talks that are offered at the same time. So this morning's no exception.
And as you know, there's a bunch of killer presentations that are being given right now by some incredibly talented researchers, and we'd like to encourage all of you to go and check those out after they're posted.
With that being said, we are sincerely grateful that you've chosen to come start your morning with us, so let's get to it with some proper introductions.
My name's Christian DeMeth. Please call me Quadi. I'm more comfortable with that. I'm an emergency medicine physician early on in my training, and I'm also a DEF CON aficionado, and this is my 10th year. Played a little open capture the flag, and I'm just, it's like a second home to me here.
I'm Jeff Tully. I'm a pediatrician. I just want to tell everyone that vaccines don't cause autism. So pass that around.
I'm Peter Heffley. I work for SNRA as an IT security consultant, and I've seen several episodes of HouseMD. So, a standard legal boilerplate. This talk is neither sponsored, endorsed, or affiliated with any of our respective professional institutions or companies.
No unethical or illegal practices were used in the researching, acquiring, or presenting of the information contained in this talk. All of the girls you are going to see are consenting adults over the age of 18.
That was good. Do not attempt any of the theoretical or practical TAC concepts we talk about in this presentation. We promise you, you will go to jail and will not be the fun kind of jail.
The pound me. One last thing I want to make sure we emphasize. We've done a lot of work to learn a great deal about how the 911 system works, and we've had some really unique opportunities to explore behind the scenes in some ways, but we're certainly not claiming to be world experts in 911. The 911 systems in our country have such varying implementations, and the attacks that we talk about in this talk may or may not apply to all of them, and most certainly may not apply abroad.
And then just the last little bit of our disclaimer here. We're going to play two audio recordings of 911 calls. They're rather disturbing. If you're sensitive to that kind of stuff, maybe go check out another talk or just plug your ears. All right, with that in mind, I'm sure many of you guys are wondering, what the hell are these clowns doing up here? What do we know about 911? Well, this actually starts 4 years ago. Jeff and I began working on some medical research involving the pre-hospital realm, specifically out-of-hospital cardiac arrests and how 911 dispatchers teach people how to do CPR over the phone. It's a life-saving intervention. What that essentially meant at the end of the day is that we've listened to thousands of 911 call recordings.
And as we listened to a multitude of these calls, including dozens where technical issues prevented the dispatcher from immediately identifying the location of the caller, thus delaying a medical response, we realized that we really knew nothing about the technical infrastructure behind 911. And this is just a slide of some of the papers that we actually ended up publishing about dispatch and 911.
And furthermore, after listening to some of these calls where there are some technical limitations, we really wanted to dive a little bit deeper and see what are the security measures that are really being put in place here to prevent abuse of the system.
So a little background, my wife went to school with these two and we became great friends, we played D&D, we drank beer together. As someone not behind the scenes from a medical perspective, I was fascinated when they would talk about this because I feel like this is one of those things that we just take for granted. I mean, when do you think the last time these emergency response centers conducted any type of risk assessment or vulnerability scans against their systems?
So that's kind of how we all got together and thought, hey, this is really something that we should probably research formally.
And this talk's really a result of that. We're going to talk a little bit about an outline here. We're going to start with why you all are here this morning, why this talk really matters.
We're then going to go over a 30,000-foot view of exactly how these systems are designed to work, and then we're going to talk about the research methods that we used and the avenues we were able to explore.
And next, we're going to hit some attacks that we feel serve to emphasize particular points about where these systems are most vulnerable.
And then we hope to loop it back to people, our patients, your family members, your friends, because that's how we came into all of this. So let's start with an example of why this stuff matters. This is going to be a call recording of a rather disturbing 911 call, as mentioned previously. Just be prepared.
address, ma'am?
Yeah, a little sobering there. We've also thought about incorporating a laugh track, so you guys don't get particularly depressed. That's how the 911 system's supposed to work, so very quick flow, address, get out on the gate, and get someone help. This is the subsequent call. The caller calls back a few minutes later, and this is the recording.
911 emergency. Oh my God, where are you guys at? He's on the floor, he's turning blue, he's dying. Oh my God, where are you? He's not breathing anymore, I don't know what to do. Please help me, please help me.
Okay, ma'am, I'm taking out the paramedics right now.
Oh honey, please hold on, they're coming, hold on, please honey.
Ma'am, they're having difficulty finding your house.
What? I live at 1375 Orange Street.
They're at the intersection at Palm and Orange Street.
So yeah, definitely pretty heavy stuff. And thankfully, most of the time, the emergency medical system works really well to respond to serious situations like that call.
And there's a lot that goes into this response, and there's a lot that we rely on in an emergency. If my heart were to stop right now, optimist forbid, I would hope one of you would call 911.
And
there you
go. Yeah, do CPR. And then hopefully you would call 911 on your Ninja Networks phone here.
And that call would be carried by a wired or a wireless provider to a dispatch center where people with freakishly unnatural zen-like calmness respond to it.
They're then going to relay that information to the firefighters and paramedics on the ambulances and fire engines, who will then take you for definitive treatment.
And if this is done in a timely enough process, you hopefully exit the hospital through this door and not through this one. So exactly how does this system work, and is it as secure, effective, and safe as it could be? And are these questions even worth asking? And we thought so.
So when we began this, we had a couple of goals when beginning to explore this field. We wanted to understand the components of the system, better identify areas of vulnerability.
We also wanted to get a better idea of some of the attacks that have happened before, along with any solutions that may have been implemented in their aftermath.
And finally, we wanted to see if our research would lead to any ideas for solutions to problems that haven't been addressed yet. We'll talk a little bit about the future of 911 and how understanding the future state can help us identify potential weaknesses, attacks, and solutions for the system's next evolution.
So research, we've been saying that a lot. What exactly does it mean in this case? As you can imagine, it's not easy to walk into a dispatch center or a server room and ask to take a look around. As one of the main themes we hope to convey to you today is how difficult it can be to get the conversation started with the people in charge of these systems. One of the advantages that we had in our prior research is that we had a lot of contacts within a 911 system. We kind of got a little bit of access to these systems that other people might not have.
And we're obviously going to keep those partners anonymous, but we did have a number of doors open that really allowed for a variety of ways to collect the information that we're going to share with you today, from in-person interviews to process observation to regional surveying.
And as you can imagine, practical experimentation on a live 911 system can be a little bit dicey if you're not too careful. But we'll tell you about a few examples of how we messed around with this system without getting in too much trouble.
And a persistent element that has continued through all of this and will hopefully continue through the future of our research is the development of solutions that will enhance and strengthen this infrastructure.
So without any further ado, let's get to our 30,000 foot view. And we're going to start by looking at how the 911 structure currently operates with the simplest of examples, which is a wired telephone call.
Here, an individual will pick up their telephone call or their home phone and dial 911. The call reaches the end office dedicated by their telco provider, at which point the telco attaches subscriber information onto the call, specifically the automatic number identification, or ANI. This functionality tags the subscriber's billing telephone number onto the call, at which point the voice call and unlimited amount of data, or the ANI, persist forward.
Recognizing that this is an emergency call, the end office will send that call to the selective router over dedicated emergency call trunks. The selective router's function in E911, or enhanced 911, is to route the call to an appropriate public service answering point. That's the PSAP. We're going to call that from now on. Public service answering point is the PSAP. And that routing is based on the ANI to PSAP mounting or routing that it maintains. If for some reason the call comes in without ANI information or the ANI is corrupted, the selective router will send the call to a designated PSAP based on the default route, much in the way that routers we're all familiar with work.
When the selective router sends this call tagged with the ANI information onto the PSAP, it can do so over a dedicated trunk, ISDN line, or POTS line. Once the call reaches the PSAP, a dispatcher will answer the call, frequently assisted by a computer-aided dispatching system, or CAD system. At this point, it's really important that the dispatcher be able to accurately determine two things about the caller. The first is, where's the caller located? We need to know this so that they can dispatch responses to the appropriate location. And the second thing is, what public services actually service that address or that location? Is it county fire, city police, and a local ambulance company?
So to get this information quickly, the PSAP, usually through a CAD like we talked about, does a lookup against a database. The PSAP's going to send the caller's ANI information, and in response gets an automatic location identification or ALI record back. This information and the database that it's stored in are usually maintained by a for-profit third party. So just kind of recap, you pick up your phone, you dial 911, Comcast is going to send that emergency call along with some identifying details to a selective router, which then sends your call to the dispatcher at the PSAP, and you hear, 911, what's your emergency? All the while, your location is being determined in the background by the ALI database.
Now things get a little bit more complex when the caller can move around, as in the case of cellular telephones. Have you ever called 911 when you're not at home? Maybe when you're out of state on vacation? How is it that your call is answered by a PSAP that is close to your physical location and not based on your billing address or your area code? How does that work? Well, the answer truly varies, and it depends on the implementation of E911 standards based on the physical location that you're in. One is called Wireless Phase 1, that's got the older version, a little bit less accurate, and then Wireless Phase 2, which is what is being rolled out around this nation right now.
Starting out by talking through phase one, which is displayed here. When you make a cell phone call, your call reaches a cellular telephone tower maintained by a provider. In a phase one scenario, that call is passed along by the tower to a mobile switching center, which starts the bifurcation of location data and the voice call. You can think of this as the location information flowing along the bottom in yellow, and the call flowing in red over familiar infrastructure to the selective router and then along to the PSAP.
So in phase one, your location is approximated based on the cell tower that you're using, that location, and the sector or face of the tower which is handling the call. So the mobile switching center is going to send the cell tower location, cell tower sector handling the call, and what we call the callback number or CBN to a mobile positioning system, which then, this is a little bit complex, it provides you a token called the Emergency Services Routing Key, ESRK, or a pseudo ANI or PANI. And the PANI basically provides the same function as the ANI in our wired telephone call. It's this little token that is then used to tag the call from the mobile switching center to the selective router and then onto the PSAP.
And in this scenario, the selective router looks up the appropriate PSAP, because you don't want to be sent to a dispatch center that's not in physical proximity to you or can send the right strike package. And in this situation, that's based on mapping between the cell tower face and the appropriate PSAP. On the bottom here, you can see that the mobile positioning center forces the CBN, cell tower location, and cell tower sector into a temporary ALI record. And that's referenced by the ESRK or the pseudo ANI, the PANI. This way, when the PSAP does a lookup for the caller's location based on the PANI, they receive the information in their computer-aided dispatch screen. And all this is done seamlessly and automatically.
So this is what the CAD is going to show the dispatcher. We've got your callback number there up top. The next thing that's provided is the emergency services number or the PSAP identifying number. Then we have the wireless carrier name, the cell tower location, the PSAP name, the call type, the carrier, that we have our little temporary ESRK or PANI, and the location. If this were a real lookup, you'd also see an emergency services strike package, which basically tells you what police, fire, and ambulance providers are going to end up servicing that location.
Wireless Phase 2 is an enhancement beyond Phase 1, which allows the PSAPs to precisely locate wireless callers using the cellular provider's positioning determination equipment, seen here in the lower left. It's important to understand that this is an abstraction, and the implementation is left up to the cellular telephone provider. This allows the provider to implement whatever technology they want to determine the caller's location. This could be obtaining GPS data from the handset, signal triangulation, both, or some other technology. The delta between a phase one and a phase two call for 911 is at the actual caller's location, as opposed to a guess based on cell tower location and sector, is passed along to the Alley database. When the mobile positioning center gets the initial data for a call to include the call tower or cell tower, the tower sector, and the callback number, it queries the position determination equipment to determine where the caller's at. That data is inserted as a temporary Alley record and is provided to the PSAP when they request it. This allows the PSAP to best direct emergency responses to the correct location. In these implementations, it's also common to see a mapping system integrated with the computer-aided dispatching system that pulls up the caller's location automatically.
All right, here you can see the Alley data that's provided back from a phase two system. The major change here is that you can see the caller's location data is presented as a latitude and longitude. This is incredibly important in urban centers or rural centers where you might not be at a physical location. You might be in an alley or off some of the beaten path or perhaps in a place that isn't mapped by a physical address. The positioning system also provides a level of confidence in what's in a percentage and an uncertainty in a units of distance based on the mechanism it uses to determine your location. So to recap on wireless calls, you call 911 on your cell phone. Your voice call is sent by your wireless provider to the PSAP through the intermediaries that we've already talked about, specifically selective routers. All the while, your location is being determined either by cell tower triangulation, just cell tower sector, which would be in phase one, or using your chip in your GPS, your GPS chip in your phone. That all gets put into a database and sent to the PSAP, who then has your voice, call stream, and your estimated location so that they can send folks your way.
So the last thing that we'll talk about as far as call flows goes is using voice over IP or VoIP. So we all know about VoIP providers that reach the residential market like Magic Jack or Vonage. And in these scenarios, the VoIP service provider is going to maintain a database of information that links their subscribers to the appropriate PSAP by a location. And this is information that they frequently compile and recompile based on the subscriber's billing address.
When a VoIP caller places a 911 call, their VoIP service provider will pass that call along to an emergency services gateway, which passes the callback number or subscriber information onto the VSP database and obtains the appropriate PSAP and emergency services query key, which is just like a PANI, it's just called something different. That's that token. And from there, the call flow is very similar to what we've previously discussed. The call is forwarded onto the selective routers and to the appropriate PSAP, who gets the caller's location information from the Alley database based on the temporary record that the VSP has created with the subscriber's location information and callback number.
And if that all wasn't enough, this isn't where this process ends. So in any of the possible scenarios we talked about, whether it be wired, wireless, or VoIP, we still have to get the information from the caller to the dispatcher, and then the dispatcher has to initiate the appropriate response from the strike package delivered by the Alley data. Then they must actually contact those units and then get them dispatched. The ambulances, fire engines, and patrol cars will then arrive on scene, render help, and if necessary, transport. When an ambulance is used to transport a person in need to a receiving hospital center, there's another communication line that occurs, most often cellular, in which they're going to call that receiving center, communicate a few pertinent details about the patient, and then get acceptance or refusal from this receiving center on whether or not they can take that patient.
All right, so we've given you a pretty good overview of how the system works. Now we're going to talk about ways to take advantage of the system. But before we do that, we thought it might be a good idea to lay out some objectives that a malicious individual might have. So these are the three objectives, if you will, that we came up with for someone who wants to hack 911.
The first objective is to initiate an emergency response when one is not required or appropriate. This may be an individual who wants to disrupt business operations at a competitor, play a prank on their friend, or redirect emergency services to some end. Think about calling the cops in to respond to a major incident on the west side of town while you rob a jeweler on the east side of town.
The second goal you might have if you were an asshat is to interfere with the necessary or appropriate 911 response. Here I may want to prevent someone from obtaining medical attention, delay the response to their call, or prevent an individual or institution from using 911 services altogether. To this end, perhaps I'm interested in denying access to PSAPs themselves or the emergency responders.
And finally, there is possible value in the surveillance of emergency responders. So maybe you're an ambulance chaser, or maybe you just want to know when alarm response times will be the highest and then plan your mayhem accordingly. So let's jump in and talk about some possible weaknesses in the system.
Talking about end office control, in this scenario, either through control of an end office or through control of a PBX linked to an end office that lets you set your ANI information arbitrarily, you're able to place a 911 call with a falsified or invalid ANI field. As a result, the PSAP will not be able to determine your location with any certainty, and they will have to rely on the information that's provided verbally by the caller.
It's important to note that this type of attack can basically be accomplished using any mechanism that strips off the ANI data. You can get your call forwarded to 911, your ANI information will then be incorrect or stripped. Also, TTY services, which we'll talk about in a little bit, can take advantage of this as they may or may not include ANI data.
So all of the location determination mechanisms that we've looked at here today rely on the ALI database. And if there were some way to alter or own this database, then you could change the ALI record for a phone number to your target's address and then call in an emergency response. I mean, essentially, if you access this, you're able to force the PSAPs to rely on the location information that they're given over the phone. And we'll talk about how that may or may not be reliable. And so here, it's just really important that we highlight how the entire 911 infrastructure we've discussed on relies very heavily on this type of mechanism.
Have you ever powered on an old cell phone to look up somebody's number or look up some contact information and noticed that even though you're not paying for service on that device, the emergency call feature looks like it's enabled? That's on purpose. The 911 infrastructure was required to support these non-service initialized or NSI cell phones.
And here, there is no callback number as the phone isn't subscribing to any service. So what is the exact CBN that's provided? Well, in this situation, it's the number 911 plus the last 7 digits of the electronic serial number or International Mobile Equipment Identity Number, which is specific to the phone itself. It's kind of just like the phone's MAC address. But these calls are still subject to location determination in either the phase 1 or phase 2, depending on where you actually are at the time when you place that NSI call.
And just to kind of review, remember that with the wireless phase 2 environment, you're relying on location data from the mobile handset in addition to any tower triangulation. So it's definitely possible to inject an arbitrary latitude or longitude either through something like GPS spoofing or getting the phone to think that it is where it's not, like by modifying the firmware. So this call is still going to be routed to the appropriate PSAP based on the cell tower and face, but once the call reaches the PSAP, you have the ability to then make the PSAP think that the call is coming from an arbitrary location. And obviously this is a little bit more believable when your arbitrary location is still in the same area serviced by the PSAP and not something crazy like, oh, you're calling from North Korea.
Again, taking a look at the critical data stores along those call flows, the VoIP service provider databases, which maintain that mapping between the subscriber and their actual location, that would also be an interesting target. Changes to that database or denial of service to that aspect of the provider's infrastructure would have the same impact as modifying or denying access to the ALI database, but with potentially a different security posture than the ALI database.
So even after we get through the call flow and into the latter part of the response, we see some large areas for disrupting or altering the call. So you have to keep in mind that the PSAP itself is a physical location. And one of the people that we talked to said, when I interviewed to work at a 911 center, I expected high levels of security, guards with guns, high fences, and heavy locked doors. What I saw instead was a normal building, poor physical security, and the smiling faces of employees just waiting to be socially engineered.
Traditionally, PSAPs were segmented or air-gapped, such that phone systems, CAD systems, and general workstations for email and web browsing were all separated or broken out. PSAPs we talked to noted that segmentation barriers have gradually broken down over time to increase integration and decrease administration overhead. So penetrating these systems would not only be desirable if you wanted to see service, but could be very valuable for establishing surveillance. Some of the folks that we interviewed denied having any incident response plans or basic security practices such as antivirus in these dispatch centers.
The second potential for an attack after the PSAP itself would be to attack the responding units. Almost all fire and ambulance engines, all ambulances and fire engines I've ever been on have their own locally broadcasted cellular wireless hotspots for transmitting various things like EKGs or vital patient data from the field to the receiving hospital. These units rely on cellular connectivity. One of the individuals we interviewed talked about how on dozens of their ambulances, these wireless hotspots themselves were only encrypted with 64-bit WEP encryption. And they're using that essentially to transmit vitally important data that may or may not save this patient's life.
So we talked through some of the weaknesses in the system. Now let's talk about some actual attack scenarios.
As mentioned earlier, one of the goals an attacker of the 911 system might have would be to initiate a police, fire, or medical response to a location that is not in need of one. The most notable example of this practice is known as swatting. During swatting, an attacker initiates a 911 call and falsely reports to the dispatcher that some crime, like a hostage situation or an active shooter, is currently happening at a particular location. In more sophisticated swatting attacks, the attacker will either impersonate the target that they are trying to actually get a SWAT response to, they'll implement various obfuscation techniques to hide their identities, or they'll try to target a particular PSAP, which can be difficult and we'll talk about, to make their call more believable so that when they call that in, it'll be more likely to produce a SWAT response. Now, what you're about to hear is a call recording from an actual SWATter. It's really messed up. Pay attention to the call flow, because there's a couple things that we want to highlight here. First, the SWATter is unable to target the specific PSAP that services his target, so he actually has to get transferred. And then also perk up when that transfer happens, because there are some tones that are going to be used during the transfer call, and we'll talk about that later on.
Thanks, Lisa. My name is Crystal. How can I help you?
Listen here. I'm at Main Street in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Okay, do you know where Main Street is?
I'm not sure that is a good address, sir. Could you verify that for me?
Main Street.
Main Street. I'm not sure that is a good address.
That is an address.
Okay, what's the nearest intersection that you're by?
What do you want, the damn phone number?
Okay, go ahead and give that to me.
719-393.
Okay.
0078.
Okay, is that a home phone?
Yes, it is.
Okay, sir. And what's going on there?
Now, listen here. I've got two people here held hostage, right?
Okay.
Now, you know what happens to people that are held hostage? It's not like on the movies or nothing, right? You understand that?
Okay.
And one of them here's name is Danielle, and her father. And the reason why I'm doing this is because her father raped my sister.
Okay.
Okay. And I am armed. Okay.
Okay.
I am armed. I do have a pistol, and I swear to God, I will kill these people. If any cops come in this house with any guns,
okay,
I will fucking shoot them. I will kill them.
Okay.
Do you understand me?
Can I get your name, sir?
Yes, my name is John DeFano.
Okay, John, are you in security?
What do you mean?
Are you in the town of security? Because I'm not sure that you're in Colorado Springs. You may be right outside of my area.
Yes.
So you are in security?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm going to need to transfer you over to the sheriff's office. Will you stay on the phone with me?
Yes, I will.
Okay, hang on just one second.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Can you stick on the line with me at all? Because I'm not talking to these people anymore.
Sure, John.
I had enough of this shit.
I'll certainly do that. Okay, hang on.
Just remember, I am armed and I will shoot.
Okay, what kind of gun do you have?
I have a 22.
Okay. Is it a pistol?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you have two people there?
Yes, I do. An 18-year-old and her father.
Okay, I want you to hang on the phone with me.
They're duct taped in the next room. They are duct taped and roped together.
Okay. Let me get you over to the county, okay? And I'll hang on the phone with you, John.
All right. And you're going to be talking.
Yes, sir, I will, John.
All right.
Just one second.
Thank you.
Let them know I'm transferring it over. Do you want me to stay on the phone?
Jennifer, this is Crystal with the city. I'm transferring a call in. One of my other dispatchers is calling over there. It's going to be a hostage situation. Main Street Security.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, let me bring him on in the phone. He's wanting me to stay on the line with him.
Okay.
Johnny, you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, I have the county on the phone with us now.
Hi, John.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, okay, this is Jennifer. Okay, so what exactly is going on?
So yeah, that's pretty messed up to call and make a threat like that. And we really don't know why a lot of people want to do this. The motives vary, but you know, targets are very often, at the very least, humiliated, and there have been many reports of victims coming dangerously close to the accidental use of lethal force. So it's definitely not a benign practice.
All right, several well-known celebrities have been targets, including Justin Bieber and Ashton Kutcher. Recently in Arizona, a 15-year-old boy was a target of a swatting attack after he talked some smack on an Xbox party chat. Last year, disturbingly, we saw some journalists targeted for publishing on cybercriminal identities. So it's definitely an increasing attack.
And as we showed you earlier, the ability for a 911 system to identify who is calling and where that caller is pretty extensive. So how do attackers avoid identification of their location or their identity?
So, believe it or not, the person who swatted Ashton Kutcher and Justin Bieber was a 12-year-old boy, and he utilized a well-known telephone interpreting service for the deaf called TTY, or text telephone. This is an example of an old-ass one right here. Many deaf nowadays don't carry this stuff around. Obviously, they can use online services or there's various apps. And traditionally, these services allow a person to call a relay service with this machine. The phone number they are wishing to call is then communicated, and then the relay operator calls the number on a separate line. When that person answers, they talk to the operator, who communicates her role and that the person is using a TTY and wishes to speak with them. And then the deaf person can type the desired messages to the relay operator, who will then read them to the answering person. And then that person can then speak to the operator, who will then type back to the deaf person. Now, if an attacker dials the relay service and conveys to the operator that there is an emergency, the operator will then call 911 and report that whatever exactly the TTY person is typing. The thought here is that the TTY service strips some of the potentially identifying information of the call, such as the recording of their voice, or in some circumstances, the actual any-ally data that's attached to a normal 911 call.
So contrary to popular belief, caller ID spoofing is a method that will almost never work when it comes to masking your identity and then calling 911, because most service providers won't care what you claim your ANI information to be when you make an emergency call. It will just insert whatever ANI is supposed to be there from the record and then passes that to the ALI database as well as the PSAP. So in rare circumstances, there were a few VoIP providers that we researched that will actually pass along your proclaimed ANI without altering or amending it, but those are kind of few and far between. And furthermore, many of the ANI spoofing service providers, like the one that you see here, treat 911 calls differently and will not connect to 911 without altering the ANI back to what they have on record. However, there is one example.
One attack that can actually benefit from ANI spoofing is circumventing the automatic routing in an effort to target a specific PSAP. PSAPs have a 10-digit direct number that's publicly dialable. Calls to this direct number are treated as emergency phone calls. This number is most often used to transfer between PSAPs in case you end up with the wrong PSAP, or if the municipality the person is calling dispatches fire and police from separate centers. If an attacker uses a VoIP provider that will push that spoofed ANI all the way through, an attacker can initiate a seemingly innocent looking call from that spoofed number to the 10-digit PSAP number using the appropriate dial number and place an emergency call.
The general problem with this is that these numbers are secret, and they're impossible to discover, right, everyone out there? Impossible to discover secret things? Well, we were successful in enumerating several of these numbers by listening to the 911 call recordings that are readily available on the internet, and then listening for the DTMF tones. Remember I told you to perk up when you heard the transfer tones? So those are DTMF tones. Those aren't widely utilized. There are some other actual schemas you can use to transfer those calls. But if they use DTMF, you can then record those, run them through a tone extractor, and enumerate the 10-digit specific PSAP number. Thus, an attacker could better target a particular PSAP and avoid the automatic routing that's done upstream by the carrier once a 911 call has been dialed. You may have noticed in our swatting call that the dispatcher had to transfer the caller to another center. This would be a prime example of how difficult it can be to target a particular PSAP. If you could be successful in targeting a particular PSAP that is local to your target, you may improve your believability of your swatting call and then be more likely to actually have a swatting response.
So Remember that non-initialized phone call flow that we talked about before, where you can basically call with a SIM-less phone, and then your callback number is just basically the version of the phone's MAC address? What's interesting about this mechanism is that you have a level of abstraction between the caller and their identity if you can obtain old, used cell phones for cash off Craigslist, and the buyer doesn't know who you are, then you've just removed your identity from the standard links between a 911 call and the caller. So you get all of the mayhem that we've talked about thus far with a much smaller chance of attribution and entanglements with law enforcement.
So I know many of you guys out there use VoIP. You can use it anywhere. It's superior to a lot of traditional services. But you can call anywhere, from your cell phone, from a SIP client. You can call from a laptop in a coffee shop. How does your VoIP provider allow you to change your location? Is there any verification of that location data against your billing address? For kicks, we actually tried a major VoIP provider here in the US and observed the 911 location mapping functionality and features that were available to us. Here you can see a web request made when we used a thick client to update our location to the VSP database. Interestingly enough, we were able to change our location to each other's addresses and other addresses without any notable verification.
So how do you stop 911 from working the way it's supposed to? There's the old-fashioned cable cut, as seen here, and that'll stop your target from calling 911 with at least their landlines. Cell phone jamming is also a possibility. If you want to conduct some crime and prevent folks from dialing 911, a cell phone jammer will provide you localized disruption of services. If you can edit that VSP or alley record that we talked about earlier for your target, you may be able to ensure that even if they call 911, the response is directed to the wrong location. Think about that web request you just saw, and think about some of the problems you've seen with web servers. Would it be possible to use that to change somebody's entry or record? Let's say you want to get your murder on. If you can alter the VSP or alley record for your intended target, mind you, now it's premeditated, then you might be able to direct to emergency responders to the wrong location if you don't allow your victim enough time to state their true location to dispatchers before you off them.
A major weakness in many telephone systems, obviously, to include 911 is resource consumption. So a PSAP only has so many dispatchers available to answer calls, right, and only so many trunk or phone lines for these calls. If you can tie them all up, then you've denied access to 911. So this is obviously a telephony denial of service or TDoS attack. And what's been interesting is that the FBI recently published a white paper that's saying that these types of attacks on PSAPs and even hospitals are actually increasing substantially. And interestingly enough, there's a talk tomorrow, track one at 10 a.m., I believe, that involves hacking a cell phone's firmware to make it an automatic dialer. So you got a portable TDoS.
I'd like to draw attention to one particular example of TDoS, because we get this question all the time. You're talking about 911. Is anyone actually doing this? And they are. A few years ago, some jackass TDoSed an entire bank of phones at a San Francisco hospital. And not only were the lines in the emergency department that take calls from the incoming ambulances, things like trauma and heart attacks and strokes, disrupted, but inter-hospital communication between services was also disrupted. So imagine the ICU teams trying to talk to the ICU docs, et cetera, et cetera. And when smooth communication is disrupted, patients' lives can be at risk here. It is that important of a thing.
And we already talked about the PSAP as being a location with inherent vulnerabilities, but attacks like TDoSing highlight the fact that these are places staffed with people who use machines to do work. Therefore, if you're either to overwhelm the human ability to respond to calls or take out the systems that they use to facilitate that response, you can generate a negative impact. Unfortunately, based on our research, many of the PSAPs are understaffed and continue to support legacy computer systems due to budgetary constraints. And as noted earlier, traditional segmentation barriers between the systems which support emergency response and those that support administrative functions are on decline.
That's fine.
These organizations have all the same challenges of a small company with limited budgets, extremely high availability demands, and customers who want rapid response. You have to imagine how challenging it can be to keep up this type of organization and keep it secure.
So what happens if you were successful in TDoSing a particular PSAP? Well, that hasn't happened on a larger scale, but what we did see is an accidental denial of service for 6 hours. In April, 4,500 calls over 6 hours to 911 were denied in Washington, Oregon, portions of California, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina. The Alley database had exhausted its call tracking tokens that it attributes to that, and no new calls could be routed. So essentially when people called 911, they got a busy signal. During this time, one woman was documented to have called 911 37 times and got the busy signal every single time while an attacker actively tried to break into her house. What about people that are having, during that time, that had heart attacks and strokes? Did they suffer damage that they can never get back, or did they die as a result of that delayed 911 response?
So swatting Justin Bieber is great, but what about when you mess with the 911 system when people actually need it and they can't depend on it? So what is the true impact of a 911 hack? And how do you measure the cost to, say, a Betty White with a heart attack who can't get help because somebody changed their address in the Alley database? So let's kind of talk about that. How much do even minute-long delays cost end up costing victims?
Well, it's kind of hard to say without being able to predict the future, but with the most serious medical problems, mere minutes can mean the difference between life and death. Take cardiac arrest, for example. In our state, the average time from when you pick up the phone and call 911 to when someone arrives at your house is about 6 minutes. And a lot of you out there are thinking, wow, that's really long. But that's actually really an amazing response time for the United States. When someone has a cardiac arrest, you can see that their survivability decreases greatly without intervention. At about 2 minutes without oxygen, heart muscles begin to die, and at the 6 minute mark, they have less than a 50% chance of survival.
So CPR can extend these windows, but our hypothetical victim is still looking at significant increases in mortality with every minute that passes. So it's not unrealistic to say that even a delay of 5 to 10 to 15 minutes can actually end up killing people.
And this is a similar pattern with all kinds of things other than cardiac arrest. From penetrating trauma to strokes to breathing problems.
Taking a step back and thinking on a more global scale, these systems are heavily relied upon by individuals who are in a dire situation when they need to make a 911 call. Consider the benefits to a foreign state or a non-state threat agent to exploit or deny access to emergency response systems. Furthermore, note that it would be possible to target any country or locality's emergency response infrastructure, not just the United States. Imagine the loss of confidence, panic, or loss of life which could occur if this infrastructure were targeted to accomplish state or non-state based objectives. We talked a lot about potential problems, but we also want to talk about some potential solutions for the issues we noted. One of our objectives when we started this research was not just to poke holes in something which we all really appreciate. I haven't needed to use 911 services yet, but after this talk is over, I intend to drink my way into an ambulance ride. Before I get to that, let's talk about a few of the solutions we've come up with to address the issues highlighted so far. In the current global payment environment, it's possible for each transaction to be assessed for potential fraud indicators. This can occur when the delivery address doesn't match the billing address or the payer's name doesn't match the recipient. These are simple examples, but the fraud catches available for the payment environment are pretty robust, with thresholds configurable on merchants and payment networks.
So we're going to really quickly hit some of these. So like what if the 911 system had call routing red flags to allocate risk ratings based on indicators seen? And maybe these red flags don't result in priority or queuing changes, but rather kind of result in indicators or alerts on the CAD system.
And what we're saying is we don't want dispatchers to focus on things that don't matter. We want them to deliver care in a timely fashion. But maybe there's some way that we can assign confidence values or validity values as they come in and assign them to each call.
So for denial of service, why don't we use some of the solutions that we've seen in application or networking areas, like in order to negate PSAP resource consumption by TDOSing, insert some sort of proof of work or intelligence system, kind of like a CAPTCHA.
And this doesn't have to be nearly as robust as it sounds. Why not use common things that we've seen in other services, like press 2 for English and para española prima 4, excuse my Spanish, and that might be 3 for English and 8 for español. We don't want to cut into response times here with something complex, but simple scenarios like this might be used to mitigate TDoS attacks.
At a more national level, we want to highlight that these organizations, which have done a phenomenal job helping folks day in, day out, have done so with limited security standards to guide them on what they can do to protect this infrastructure. The National Emergency Number Association, or NENA, published a security standard for next generation 911 systems. However, there's no express penalty for non-compliance. Experts in the field that we spoke to estimate that under a half of the organizations actually comply with these standards, citing disparate, often constrained budgets. By recognizing the importance of the service and the need to secure it, we may be able to help get resources and motivation to the organizations that need them in order to protect life and limb.
So we're kind of running pretty low on time here. We didn't do a very good job of our time management. Let's kind of pop to the end. It's really difficult to condense all of this material into 45 minutes. We have a lot more that we'd like to talk about as far as solutions and further contributing to make the system a little bit better. So if you have any experience at all with 911 or would like to collaborate with us or have any further questions, find us around. We'll get you our emails. We'll get in touch with you because we would love to talk to you. I'm sorry that we ran a little bit late there at the end.
We really want to emphasize how much respect we have for the hard work that everyone involved in this process does on a daily basis. From the folks at the phone companies to local, municipal, state, and federal officials, from dispatchers to first responders, every stakeholder in this process goes to work every day, hoping and, you know, working to support a system that saves lives. And we really want to thank them for those efforts, but still highlight that there are aspects of this system that could be secured better.
All right, well, let's thank them, all the peer responders. We thank you for showing up to our talk.